Okay, go ahead. We're ready.
I would like to call this Online Planning Commission work session order for Thursday, April 7th, 2022. My name is Matt Swindell, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Clark County Planning Commission. Due to the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, regular meetings and public hearings of the Clark County Planning Commission will be held in a virtual meeting room. This will allow for safe participation by commission members, staff, and the public. Members of the public, applicants, and planning commission members have joined us as an attendee, which means you can see and hear the event if you've joined via computer or mobile device, or you can just hear the event if you join by phone. Other event participants cannot see you on video and cannot hear your audio unless you are acknowledged by the commission chair or staff and are unmuted. There will be no public comment during this work session, but members of the public can watch and listen. This evening's agenda is planned as followed. Called to order. And then Clark County Housing Options Study. Then action plan. And four will be the comments from members in the Planning Commission, and then adjournment. With that, are you guys ready to go? Oliver, I guess it goes to you.
Yes, good evening, Planning Commission members. My name is Oliver, Clark County Community Planning.
Oliver?
Yes, Clark County Community Planning. Good evening, members of the Planning Commission. Before we start, I really want to acknowledge our consulting team, 3J consulting team. They were the consultant on this project, and I want to extend my sincere thanks to the great work they have done. And that includes community planning staff. I'm not going to call them one by one, but I guess I could. Jackie, Jenna, and Susan, and our entire support staff. Our consulting team have really shown their professionalism in terms of the understanding of housing affordability challenges and the way that they have conducted this study, and the process that they've taken through to get us here, the extensive public participation effort that they conducted. So I greatly appreciate that. And thank them very much for that and the work that they will still do in the future. And Planning Commission members, quickly before I turn it over to the consulting team and our staff, what is before you is the Housing Option Study and Action Plan. That is really the title. And it's not new to the Planning Commission members. This housing affordability has been a challenge, and is still a challenge, and conversation what to do about that, both at the federal, state, and local government. So the purpose of the study is to really focus on helping local governments to really understand the local housing challenges. In this case, this study focuses on the unincorporated portion of the Vancouver UGA, and that's the area that the county has. It's urban in nature, and the county has land use jurisdiction in addition to the rural area. But this study focuses on the unincorporated Vancouver UGA. And the reasons for that is that those are the areas where you have increase in density, where you will find multi-family duplexes, condominium, townhouses. Those are not allowed in the rural area. So that's why they focus on the unincorporated portion of the Vancouver UGA. The Action Plan or the Housing Study and Action Plan identifies strategies and implementation actions that promote greater housing diversity, affordability, and also provide opportunity for residents of a low to moderate income households. The primary focus of the study is to identify ways to encourage development of affordable housing in a greater variety of housing type and densities, as I mentioned, multifamily, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and so forth. And we are hoping, and you will agree as we go through the strategies and the recommendation coming out of the advisory group, that this is an effort to encourage the creation of affordable housing to low and moderate income household by identifying and removing regulatory barriers and consider other strategies, and also providing access to affordable quality and opportunity to create housing that are affordable, not only for current residents, but hopefully for future residents. So you will find that the strategies that the group recommended included timelines for implementation, as well as provide for monitoring so that we can see how successful we are as we continue to implement this. Some of this is action that you will be recommending to the council, and hopefully the council will recommend that the strategies be implemented. Staff will go in depth as to how the strategies are structured. I mentioned timeline. Some of the strategies are categorized in short term, midterm, and long term. So with that, let me turn it over to staff and the consulting team to go over in details about the study, the process they went through, and why we are here before you, recognizing that your hearing will be in 2 weeks' time. So during that 2 weeks, if you have questions, both staff and our consulting team are available to hopefully address your concerns or questions as we hear what they are tonight, as you prepare for your hearing. With that, let me turn it over to staff and our consulting team. So thank you. I'm also here to answer questions.
Thank you, Oliver. good evening, planning commissioners. This is Jackie Camp. Thanks for joining us this evening. It's such a beautiful, it's like the unicorn spring day today. And I'm sure everyone wishes we could all be playing outside. But I looked ahead at the forecast for your hearing, and it looks like it's going to be only 66 and maybe some rain. So hopefully you'll feel more likely to want to be inside. Oliver mentioned, a big shout out to our team, our project team. Steve and Elizabeth are here and will be presenting information to you tonight. I also want to thank Jenna and Susan from our staff, who has been integral to this. So they're here as well to answer any questions. So tonight's presentation will provide an overview of the action plan, including review of the advisory group's 50 recommended strategies, and which they developed through a consensus-based approach. A few things I just want to highlight to keep in mind as we run through the presentation is that the recommended strategies in the plan that we'll go over tonight include potential changes to the comprehensive plan, county code, zoning map, and or other non-regulatory recommendations for council to consider. The strategies are recommendation only and will require the council to direction to move forward with implementation. You can leave it here, Sonia. Many of the strategies require a separate legislative approval process to be implemented, such as a code or policy change. Other strategies are administrative, such as creating a web page to provide resources for mobile and manufactured homeowners, or identifying an affordable point of contact at the county for affordable housing projects, which could be implemented immediately if the council directed us. But most of them are code and mostly are code related, or a lot of them are. And so those, if they move forward with implementation, will get more review, and then of course have to go through the type 4 process that comes before you all for implementation. So just wanted to kind of keep that in mind. Also, the scope of work for this project and the contract that we have with our consultant team included the try to do some implementation ready strategies. I think the council really wanted to not only study the issue, but had the momentum to keep it moving forward and try to get something done as soon as we could, right? So although there are no like implementation ready strategies that we are ready to adopt right now in the plan, many of them, such as the short-term ones, can be implemented pretty shortly, like we're saying in the timeline, under a year. With assistance from the consultant team, if we get that direction from council to move forward with those immediately. So lastly, as Oliver had mentioned, that we have and we'll discuss it later in the plan, but there's a monitoring program. So we don't want this to just sit on the shelf. We have put into the plan a monitoring program that not only talks about how you would monitor strategies that are implemented and how they're making an impact or not, and also monitoring the overall implementation of this plan. So going back to council and giving progress reports and to you all on what we've accomplished so far and next steps for further implementation of strategies. So with that being said, we'll go on to, can you go to the next slide, Sonia? So this gives you all have heard about this project over the last couple of years, but just to, you know, a reminder, Clark County and other communities across the state are struggling to provide a variety and quantity of housing options that residents need. New strategies are needed to help ensure future generations have access to affordable, quality, and diverse housing opportunities. So the purpose of this study and action plan was to understand our local housing challenges and identify opportunities to encourage the creation of additional housing types that are affordable to a variety of households within the unincorporated Vancouver urban growth area. And as we've talked about, this could be done through the removal of regulatory barriers or implementation of other types of strategies. A little background to how we got to this point in 2018, the County Council had made amendments to the development code. So you all, those that were sitting on the Planning Commission in 2018, remember this, to allow more flexibility for the development of accessory dwelling units, cottage housing, and manufactured housing. The Washington State Legislature has also recently passed a new housing-related legislation related to ways local governments can expand housing options. So the council was interested in finding additional ways after that 2018 effort to provide more housing in the Vancouver unincorporated urban growth area that is attainable to people with a variety of incomes. So the project area, as Oliver mentioned, is a large urban area, has an estimated population of 161,000. Next to, but not incorporated into, the city of Vancouver. This area is the focus of the county, as Oliver had mentioned before, because of its urban jurisdiction where different types of housing can be built. So duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, condos, multifamily apartments, et cetera. And it's where the urban services are available and can be provided in an efficient manner. The plan provides guidance for county staff, elected officials, and other decision makers to encourage the construction of additional affordable and market rate housing that meets the unincorporated Vancouver urban growth area's current and future housing needs. And they include potential strategies that could be related to the comprehensive plan, county code, zoning map, and other types of administrative strategies. Next slide. So this slide tries to show kind of how the housing action plan relates to the comprehensive plan and our development regulations. So, you know, the county, of course, as you know, under the GMA, is required to plan for housing, including housing affordable to lower income households. The Growth Management Act includes specific requirements on how cities and counties should do this. The GMA goal for housing is plan for and accommodate housing affordable to all economic segments of the population of the state, promote a variety of residential densities and housing types, and encourage preservation of existing housing stock. So that's the overall GMA housing goal. The Growth Management Act and the RCWs, have other goals that relate to housing, such as encourage development in urban areas where adequate public facilities and services exist or can be provided in an efficient manner, reduce the inappropriate conversion of undeveloped land into sprawling low density development, and ensure that those public facilities and services necessary to support development shall be adequate to serve the development at the time the development is available. So the county's comp plan has a housing element, so a chapter on housing, and the purpose of that housing chapter is to identify the need and mechanisms that will lead to the construction and preservation of decent housing for all economic segments of Clark County population. The policies in the housing element are intended to coordinate the housing policies of Clark County and all its jurisdictions to ensure that all existing and future residents are housed in safe and sanitary housing appropriate to their needs and means. So the county's development regulations, Clark County Title 40, Clark County Code Title 40, implements the vision and policies in the comprehensive plan. And the code dictates how the built environment will develop. So as you see in the chart, the action plan can inform housing, land use, and other policies outlined in the comp plan. It can also guide implementation of those comp plan policies by identifying strategies such as amendments to development regulations and implementation procedures to further encourage housing development to meet our goals and policies. Next slide. So this slide just indicates the Planning Commission specific participation we've had with you all through the project. Since the beginning, we've been trying to give you periodic updates of the progress of the report. A few of you also at the very beginning participated in the stakeholder interview process that was to help frame the project. And we also had a Planning Commission member, Ron Barca, who participated as a member of the project advisory group. Next slide. This slide shows the overall schedule, the phases of the plan and the project. So, starting in 2020, understanding the issues, the review and analysis which is the bulk of the housing option study piece of the document. The advisory groups work to learn about that and then develop recommendations and go out to the public and hear from them was phase three, phase four, putting it all together so that we could get to this point tonight, as well as the next phase, the phase we're also in to do the legislative process. Next slide. So this slide indicates, shows the project advisory group, and that was part of initiated through the approval of the public participation plan, which was one of the first steps we took to get the project going. So that was adopted by council in November of 2020. And the intent of a public participation plan is to ensure that the county facilitates a thoughtful, open, and equitable process to provide residents, workers, and other interested parties meaningful opportunities to discuss housing challenges and develop solutions for their communities. So that full participation plan is part of the Appendix B of the report, if you are looking for that. Part of that plan included the initiation of an 18-member advisory group to provide input throughout the project and assist the county with developing recommendations for consideration. So the advisory group represented a variety of interest groups and stakeholders, including realtors and housing developers, advocates for affordable housing, people who are houseless, people who are aging or have a disability, communities of color, representatives for neighborhoods, representatives for schools, representatives for youth, and employers. So the PAG met, or the advisory group, met regularly for a year to learn and understand the issues and develop these consensus-based recommendations. Next slide. So this slide shows some additional tools that we used for community engagement and public participation, including that two virtual public meetings that we had. And you can see this graphic here was our, we utilized a tool called Google Jamboard, where we had the opportunity to use virtual post-its, kind of like, even if you were, you know, sometimes we use a similar tool in an open house where you would put post-its on boards. We also had online questionnaires, CVTV videos, and other briefings and meetings with stakeholders and interested persons. Okay, next slide. Well, that's kind of a overview of the project. I'm going to pass it over to Steve, but I'll pause here to see if anyone has any questions so far. Okay. All right, doesn't look like any. So Steve, I'll go ahead and pass the baton to you.
All right, thank you, Jackie and Oliver, and thank you, commissioners. Good evening, thank you for meeting with us. My name is Steve Faust with 3J Consulting. It's been our pleasure to assist the county with this important effort. And a little bit earlier, Jackie walked you through the process that we went through to get to where we are today. And the first piece of that work was understanding the issues. So we undertook several different activities of understanding the issues and analysis that included stakeholder interviews that helped us understand development trends, barriers, and opportunities. Met with a number. This was right at the beginning of the pandemic. So we met mostly via phone and video chats. But we were able to reach representatives of a large portion of our study area. Housing data collection and analysis, which helped us understand trends in housing production and demographics. We did an analysis of land use policies, zoning, and regulations to understand that regulatory landscape. We conducted a legislative review to summarize recent Washington state housing legislation. And we developed several case studies to gather inspiration, learn best practices, and discover if any initiatives from other places might be suitable for Clark County. Next slide, please. So I'm going to walk through just some of the key findings from that work. The first finding of note is that housing is getting increasingly expensive in the Vancouver urban growth area. Wage growth has been outpaced by increases in both rents and very significantly in home sales prices. Next slide, please. We also learned that single-family owner-occupied dwellings are the predominant housing type in the county, but don't necessarily reflect the entirety of local needs. You can see in these charts here that nearly 60% of households in our study area are 1 to 2 person households, but 70% of the housing stock is 3 and 4 bedroom units. So there's a little bit of disconnect here. Another thing we learned from our outreach is that impact and development fees are high. We heard from our stakeholder interviews and not scaled to support the development of housing types with smaller footprints. So again, some disconnect there between the demographics and what we're seeing in terms of housing production. Next slide, please. So the relatively small supply of land for medium and high density residential development really limits the variety of housing options that get built. You can see here that a large majority of both land that's zoned residential and actual buildable land that's zoned residential is limited to low density housing. Next slide, please. So the aging of baby boomers and the household formation of millennials is going to drive demand for renter and owner-occupied housing of all sizes. Most single-family detached units that are for sale in the study area cost approximately $400,000. which is unaffordable to many potential home buyers. You can see on this chart that really only households who make 120% of median family income on the far right-hand side of that graphic are able to purchase homes at that price point. Households at the lower and middle part of the income spectrum often have no choice but to pay increasingly higher rents because homeownership is simply out of reach. Next slide, please. So we know that between the current underproduction of housing units in our study area and the future need based on population projections for the next, through 2035, that this area of the county will need more than 13,000 units over the next 15 years. And if you look at the chart on the right, you can see that about half of them will be needed for households that make 120% or more of average median income, area median income. But we know that those households will most likely just be taken care of by the market, not necessarily for the approximately 3,000 households that are in the 80% to 120% AMI range, and definitely not for households making less than 80% of area median income. Next slide, please. So we worked with our project advisory group, and based on our understanding from all the activities that we undertook, we developed some objectives for the Housing Options Study and Action Plan. And there's five of them here. The first is to encourage housing development that meets the needs of middle-income households who are not being served in the current housing market. So that's that 80% to 120% range. Developing strategies to support the development of housing that is affordable to low, very low, and extremely low income households. That's less than 80% area median income. We want to encourage diversity in housing types and tenure, so both rental and ownership opportunities, including expanding middle housing options and increasing multifamily feasibility. We want to encourage the creation of a broad range of housing sizes to match the needs of all types of households, with a focus, based on that information I provided earlier, on smaller homes that might serve 1 to 2 person households that aren't currently being served in the market. And then finally, to guide the development of diverse housing options into areas with access to things like transportation corridors and transit, commercial services, schools and parks and other amenities, and conversely, to support the development of those amenities in areas where we have where more housing is being added. Next slide, please. So with those objectives in mind, we started with a guidebook from the state on developing a housing action plan in terms of the full universe, if you will, of potential strategies. And over the course of a year or so, worked with the project advisory group to narrow that full universe of potential strategies down to the ones that they thought and we thought collectively are best suited to this area of Clark County. Next slide, please. So about 50 strategies were developed, and we organized them into these four categories. Just to help people read through them and break them up into bite-sized chunks based on the types of strategies. So first we have housing options. These are regulatory strategies that expand housing development options and enhance the feasibility of existing housing options. We have affordable housing strategies to increase the feasibility of subsidized affordable housing for those low, very low, and extremely low income households. We have program and partnership strategies that relate to the administration of county programs, and where the county's role is to support and collaborate with partners to develop solutions to community concerns. And many of those partners were members of our project advisory group, and their guidance and advice was invaluable. And then finally, advocacy strategies where the county could advocate for changes to state legislation to allow different strategies and tools that aren't currently available to the county. Next slide, please. So we are going to go through each of the strategies. So get ready. And please don't be afraid, since there's so many strategies, don't be afraid to ask questions as we go along, because it might be really hard to remember your questions after we get through all 50 strategies. But I will say that for each, we provided some key information. The proposed timeline, short term is a year or less, medium term 1 to 2 years, and long term 2+ years. And I'll just echo Jackie's comments from earlier that we hope to move forward with many of the short term strategies for the ones that get approval from council. We have a relative comparison of costs. We have a relative comparison of staff time and funding resources. We have household income targets. And then the type of action that's needed, whether it's administrative work or legislative action, which Jackie spoke to earlier. Next slide, please. So I'm going to introduce Elizabeth Decker with JET Planning. She is going to take you through the housing option strategies and a few of the affordable housing strategies. And then she'll hand it back to me, and I'll continue on with the rest of our strategies. Before we get started, do we have any questions?
Yes, Steve, this is Aldo. Just a quick question on when we have a question, who do we direct it to? It seems that we have you as a resource and Elizabeth and our staff member, Jackie. So do we just kind of put it out there and you guys can pick up who's going to respond?
Yeah, I would say probably direct it to the person who's speaking at the time of your question, and then they can decide if they want to answer it themselves or hand it over to someone else on the team.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Okay, Elizabeth.
All right.
Well, this is Eldon. I do have a question before you get going.
Okay.
Were you able to look at all these strategies, and are there some that are most impactful to achieving lower cost options for housing? I mean, there's 50 strategies, but maybe there's only 5 or 6 that if they got implemented, they would have the most impact on affordability. I didn't see any way to sort that out in this presentation.
Right. No, that's a good question. We did not, to assess the effectiveness of those strategies would have been another pretty significant effort in any quantitative way. So we don't have that information in any sort of quantitative manner. Oliver, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just afraid that staff could spend a lot of time on some strategies that don't have much impact on achieving lower housing.
Yeah, I would say, so we've gone through several iterations of how to organize these. And as I mentioned earlier, we landed on the 4. I think all 50 strategies that have moved forward are either strategies that we think will have, because again, we started with a much larger list, are strategies that are worthwhile because they will have a fairly significant impact, or strategies that are fairly simple to implement. So, they might not have as big of an impact, but they're kind of the low hanging fruit, so to speak. And I think the strategies that we felt would not have as significant an impact are no longer part of the list of 50 strategies. Jackie or Elizabeth, do you have anything to add?
Sure, I could jump in with just a couple points there, and just a quick good evening, Chair and Planning Commission, members of the staff. Thank you for having me here tonight. Elizabeth Decker with JET Planning to talk about some land use strategies here. But part also of our discussion of how these strategies were selected and shaped into these categories, is really that a lot of them are interrelated. So it's not necessarily about what are the top five out of the 50. In a lot of them, you know, as we'll hit on through this, it really takes, you know, 10 of them coming together that are going to have a certain impact. So we'll try to highlight that as we talk through them. But they're also, just to add to those categories of impactful and low-hanging fruit, there also were a few that, you know, are direct results of state legislation. So we need to make sure that we take care of those impacts at this time, or integrate those directions at this time.
Okay.
Yeah, any other thoughts, Jackie, before we jump into this whole list?
The only other thing I was thinking of that the PAG, the advisory group, discussed related to impacts, because a lot of the times we just don't know, right, until we try it to see how things are working. And that was kind of the thought of some of the monitoring of strategies and figuring out a way to see what impact they do have. And if it's not getting to the point of what we wanted it to do, what do we need to do to rethink and revise and relook at it to make it more impactful? So that, I think that's part of the thought process here with some of these.
And I'll add one more piece is that, excuse me, you'll see as we go through these strategies that some of them, the central idea is there, but some of the details are going to need to be determined after we go through this housing plan, housing option study and plan process when we get into the implementation. And so some of the level of impact will depend on those details and where council and the county wants to take each strategy.
And Steve, if I may, one of the things that staff will also be doing is that, as I mentioned earlier, both at the federal, state, and local level, the state is beginning to really allocate funding as it relates to housing. So there's some of this that we are going to be monitoring, funding opportunities, because that will also be key, both at the state and federal level. We are not going to be alone. So as we see additional funding coming from the state as it relates to promotion of affordable housing or affordability, we will go after those grants and tie it back to some of these strategies that we think will make a difference. So that's part of our goal.
Okay.
Hope that answered your question to some degree. And with that, Elizabeth, do you want to go ahead with the housing option strategies, please?
Yes, let's get into it. And I think that it'll also, maybe you'll get a better sense of sort of what constitutes a strategy, and understand maybe why we landed on 50 of them rather than, you know, 5 or 10. I think that together these 50 are intended to address those 5 goals that Steve was discussing about serving, you know, a variety of households based on different incomes and housing types and tenures, and matching households, household needs to availability of housing. So with that, let's just jump in. And I'll also mention my background is in a lot of code work. And so that's partly why I'm here tonight. And certainly any questions that you have around how this would get implemented through the county's development code, I am happy to answer those questions. And I appreciate that you're not a shy bunch in jumping forward. Just from a logistics perspective, I can't see everyone's screen, so don't be shy about trying to raise your hand or something. Just jump in and talk over me as needed. With that, the first piece is really looking at the existing housing types that are most prominent in our low and medium density zones. As you recall from that earlier slide, those low density zones constitute the majority of the land and the majority of the developable land in the county. And so being able to get that greater efficiency from that land by reducing minimum lot sizes for single family detached, which is far and away the most common housing type, and we expect that to continue to be a huge part of the county's housing market. Reducing those slightly by about 10 to 20% can help improve efficiencies. Similar, some changes to the townhouse lot sizes in the medium density zones, and then bringing lot sizes for duplexes into parity with single family detached lots, so that the same lot is now opened up and it's flexible, can be developed either as a single family detached or a duplex without having to resize the lot. And you know, here is probably a good example of how these strategies are going to be interrelated, and that this is not the only time you're going to hear duplexes or townhouses, but we wanted to focus on just the lot sizes piece as one strategy. So, and we think that this can be a short-term strategy, part of a package of development code amendments that could be prepared based on direction that we ultimately get from Planning Commission and City and County Council. Next slide, please. And then the next strategy is one that we heard a lot of enthusiasm from our PEG members about, and that's creating a new set of development standards for what we're terming a compact subdivision option. Right now, the county has both a cottage housing that allows some smaller scale housing and a PUD path that allows some more creative projects compared to sort of your traditional average lot sizes for single family detached. And there was really a desire to look at some smaller lots that maybe have been passed over in the, you know, 1 to 2, possibly up to 5 acres. You can see this is medium term, so we still have some refinement on these details. But the idea that this really is a more compact option to use some of those lots and get better production out of them while treating the perimeter for compatibility with adjacent development. And again, this is medium term, and it is separate from and distinct from some changes to the cottage housing standards that we'll talk about here. But the idea here is really to introduce a new option that provides for a more traditional form with smaller homes facing onto, you know, a public street, as opposed to the cottage housing that really has those same smaller dwellings, but they're focused around a common courtyard. So some distinctions in what we're trying to accomplish. And there was a lot of enthusiasm that by bringing the scale down, it could open up a lot more development opportunities. Next, please. And then jumping over, thinking about multifamily, again, we have multiple goals we're trying to support through these strategies. So this next one is about increasing the minimum density in those high density zones, where we're looking at hoping to increase the yield of multifamily residential and smaller dwelling units. Right now, the minimum densities are this range, even as low as 47% of what's permitted. And so bumping them up a little bit higher helps improve the efficiency of that land, knowing that, you know, again, if you think of those pie charts, there's a pretty small amount of high density land in the county, in this Vancouver UGA area, that and an even smaller amount that's available for development. So ensuring that the minimum density comes up helps increase the efficiency. Next, please. And then this next strategy here is about expanding middle housing types. And this is really at the heart of our strategies that came forward through the PEG about expanding the range of middle income housing opportunities. That's really the 80 to the 120% AMI, where, you know, sometimes it's called workforce housing. There are households where you've got people working, you know, good jobs like nurses, firefighters, etc., but the market is really not delivering housing right now of that single family detached variety that can match with those incomes. And so middle housing is these types of duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, townhouses, that's covered in this strategy. And by expanding those opportunities, we really bring down potentially the scale of the units, as well as the scale of the lot and the land associated with it, that can bring those housing types within a budget range that makes them really compelling homeownership opportunities. Some can also be rentals, but that's really where you get a lot of impact out of this strategy. And so in order to accomplish this, the strategy looks at changing where those uses are permitted throughout the low density zones, and also making some changes around the lot sizes and the development standards to make these, to enhance the development feasibility of them. So not just building new units, but just also this last bullet point about encouraging the internal conversion of some existing homes. That can be a strategy to add units on a site without incentivizing demolition and replacement with a new structure. So it can be a way to get more use out of an existing dwelling. Next, please. Okay, and then HO5 talks about, you know, everyone's favorite topic, minimum parking requirements. And this is a really important component that's a companion to the previous HO4 talking about introducing these middle housing types. To really enhance the feasibility of these middle housing types, the recommendation is to look at setting minimum parking requirements for duplexes, triplexes, and quadplexes that are lower than the current requirements for single family dwellings. And that's going to make it possible to fit more units onto a lot without the parking crowding out the housing. So the recommendation here is to begin by considering a one space per unit requirement and then adjusting that up or down, considering, you know, based on preferences from decision makers, as well as based on understanding some of the needs of these specific development types, as well as some of the various site characteristics. For example, whether there's on-street parking that's available nearby, whether there's high frequency transit, other influences like that could get written into the parking requirements, but we'll wanna consider all those as we introduce some minimum parking to make these new middle housing types work. Next, please. And again, still on the parking, this is where we want to take our parking focus and turn it to look at what are termed narrow lots in the county code. So that could, those are normally townhouses. They could also be a narrow lot just developed with a single family detached house. And there's additional parking requirements for those. And we see some opportunities there to both adjust the number of spaces that are required. Currently, the minimum is 2.5 spaces. You know, which is sort of an awkward number to fit on a single lot. And so making perhaps reducing that to an even 2 spaces per lot, 1 in the driveway, 1 in the garage, could improve feasibility there. But also with these narrow lots and townhouses, it's really important to look at how they're configured, the way that the driveways relate, and what the impacts are to the street frontage and on-street parking. So we see some ways to improve both the feasibility of the development while also improving the streetscape there. Next, please. And still on our parking topic, this is one of those state mandated changes that we propose to include in this short-term package of code updates. Is looking at there are some particular requirements around setting multifamily parking ratios to 1 space per bedroom, right? So a 1-bedroom apartment would have a requirement for 1 space, 2, 3, so on and so forth. For sites that have access to high quality transit, which is defined in the state legislation. So this will not affect all multifamily throughout the county or throughout the Vancouver UGA here that we're talking about, but it will have an impact on select corridors. Next, please.
Elizabeth, this is Aldo. Mm-hmm. This is one of my questions. On Great. The slide, it says state mandated and with the special ratio and relationship to a bedroom. When you actually take that to design and implementation, does that mean that there's even less space to park a car? Is it really tight? I don't understand what the advantage is here and why this relationship between the space at 0.75 and the bedroom, what are they trying to achieve?
I believe that the effort here was to preempt to a degree local jurisdictions from setting really high parking ratios for multifamily. So for example, I believe the county's recommendation or requirement is currently 1.5 parking spaces per apartment, regardless of what size the apartment is. other jurisdictions, you know, can be two spaces, or I'm not sure I've seen that much higher than that. But say you have a studio and there's only one person living in it, I think the state is trying to say they're under no circumstances should the requirement be greater than 0.75 spaces. So, you know, if you have 60 studios in your building, you know, do the math and figure out how many total spaces that is. It's essentially trying to set a cap on how much off-street parking can be required to what the drafters and the legislators felt was reasonable to balance both, you know, the demand for housing and the demand for parking, knowing that parking creates additional costs that can wind up being in a trade-off to creating creating housing.
So is a space, a parking space, a standard unit? Is it a standardized unit of space?
Yes. Yes. A parking space is clearly defined in the county's code. And, I think it's 9 feet by 20 feet or 9 by 18 feet. And there's various other standards for how the parking lots have to be developed with access aisles. There's minimum widths for all that. So this does not change the size of the parking spaces or any of the county's regulations around how parking lots are developed, just the total number of spaces.
The total number of spaces. Okay. All right. I just wanted to understand that better. Thank you for answering that.
Yeah, no, great question. Thank you. Okay, next slide, please. H08. Okay, within our Vancouver UGA, that is the study area for this project, the Highway 99 plan covers about 10 to 12% of the site area. And so this was a significant consideration in our planning, but, you know, by no means the sole focus. So we did a review of the existing standards in the Highway 99 plan. And what we heard was that there was a desire both to affirm the overall principles of the plan and continue to implement its requirements. However, there was a desire to make some limited revisions in ways that plan had resulted in some conflicts, particularly on some regulated affordable housing projects. Those are ones that are getting direct state funding, or state, local, and or national funding, and are restricted to the lower income households to help meet that need that's not being met by the market. And so there's some desire to make some adjustments there. It needs some further study and continued consultation with affordable housing designers. And so that's why this is a medium-term strategy. The other component here is that we see a need as we develop these middle housing types that we were talking about, making sure that we carry through those same types of projects and incorporate them into the Highway 99 plan, whether that's, you know, the same standards as are permitted throughout the rest of the Vancouver UGA, or if there's a way that they're particularly translated for this Highway 99 sub area. But those were the medium term needs that we saw in the Highway 99 plan. Next slide, please. All right, so I mentioned earlier the compact subdivision option, which is a new option, but this strategy, H09, is about existing cottage housing standards that the county has really already implemented and developed a strong set of standards to support cottage housing. But we saw additional sort of incremental changes to improve the feasibility of this development type. So cottage housing creates this opportunity to make clusters of smaller scale units arranged around a common open space. The idea is that there's more of a coherent site design and that parking and other like site needs can be dealt with in a collective manner rather than a more traditional subdivision with each home facing the street and each home dealing with all of its own associated needs. That by sharing facilities, there can be a greater number of units and a greater sense of community. What we've heard is that because the county already has these standards, there's been some opportunities to begin implementing them, have some prototype plans come in that have helped identify where there could be some additional improvements here.
Quick question on this one, Elizabeth. Yes. This is Aldo again. On the last bullet, remove discretionary architectural design standards. I've read through a lot of comments coming in from the public, and you know, there's a thread of concern about building these less than aesthetically pleasing places, creating, you know, it, what people are projecting in their mind is not necessarily an awesome place to live. How does that last bullet make this strategy feasible?
Mm. Yeah, I think that design, right, of structures matters both to the people that are going to live there and to the people
look at it every day.
Right. And I think the question though becomes, at what degree should the county be regulating the design, or, you know, or any government agency that has zoning powers? And so there's been broadly a push to move away from discretionary standards, where it's something like the design should be historically compatible with all structures in the neighborhood, right? It's really hard to say what that means on an individual home, and can lead to some frustration among builders and designers, where they prefer what are sometimes called clear and objective standards that say, okay, a good design means having 5 of these elements, you know, such as a front porch that meets these types of dimensions, this type of window trim, a bay window, some dormers, different types of roof styles. And so moving towards these more clear and objective standards can get at some of those pieces that neighbors would identify as, you know, good design, something that makes a home look like a home. So I would say that is a piece of it, taking out the discretionary pieces and moving to more clear and objective. But the other piece also to keep in mind, along with this strategy, is understanding the county's role in architectural design. And so we want to take a look at, for example, a lot of single family detached homes are built without discretionary architectural design standards applied by the county. And some are more to each individual's taste than others, right?
Right, it's very subjective, this is true.
Right, but if the county is not in the business of applying discretionary architectural design to every single family detached, you know, it's really a question of, does it make sense to apply that to other types of dwellings, particularly when the county could use additional variety of dwellings to meet the needs of its existing residents.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I think we're on HO10, if we would please, next slide. Okay, so this is another strategy that helps address the multifamily need, looking at apartments. And so this strategy is about continuing to provide open space and recreation requirements for multifamily projects. And those are the ones that are, you know, 13 units and above. Continuing to have a strong open space and recreation component, but adjusting the ratios a bit so that once projects are over a certain density, instead of the open space continuing to increase with each additional unit that gets added, there's really sort of a safe harbor of, if you provide, you know, this quality open space, then at the point where the open space requirements can start competing with the ability to add more housing, that there is a way to just focus on improving the quality of that open space while continuing to make the higher density projects feasible and reduce the competition for site area on a certain lot size. And we did some modeling around this, and that'll help inform our short-term strategy around really what is the balance of open space to housing to make sure that we to make sure that the regulations encourage both. All right, next strategy, please. Here's where we're talking about ADUs, or accessory dwelling units, or granny flats, or carriage houses, or whatever your preferred term is. The ADUs are another area where the county has already made significant progress. And so we identified the opportunity here to build upon and innovate the code standards. So there's a handful of strategies here that are all sort of an incremental improvement to feasibility. I'll just call out the first one about removing some parking requirements. And that part does come directly from the state. It's very similar to, well, in spirit, I don't believe it was the same bill. It's similar to the changes to the multifamily parking requirements. And so there's some clear direction also tied to the transit that we need to implement with this round of code updates. Okay, next, please. Next is, you know, we also wanted to look a little bit outside the box, right? We heard this demand that sure, there are these dwelling units, and we can look at decreasing the scale and things like cottage housing and ADUs, but also there's an increasing demand to use RVs and tiny homes as alternative residential options. And so that a key there would be to, or at least one step would be to expand where RV parks can be permitted. That's really the only place where you can have occupancy of an RV or a tiny home. RVs, if they're located on individual residential lots, they can't be used as an ADU, for example. There's restrictions on, you know, if you have someone visiting, they can't just pull up in your driveway and live there for months on end. So instead, this strategy focuses around permitting RV parks in the community commercial zone. Right now, they're only permitted in general commercial, so this would expand the opportunities for that, as well as some related work around those standards to see if there's other work that could better support this alternative. Next, please. All right, so this next one, Clark County has an amazing agency on aging, or Commission on Aging, and really looking at ways that housing can be built that supports residents, county residents of all ages and all abilities. And so a key component here is adopting a visitability program. And this could either be done with voluntary incentives or code requirements for, you know, for example, larger projects or a certain percentage of housing units. You can see this is a medium-term strategy. So, you know, again, still some details to be worked out. And this perhaps is a good example of one of those strategies that would be, depending on how it's written, could have a larger or a more modest impact, depending on its scope. But there's a few key components of making a unit visitable. This is different than ADA accessibility, but it just means that it's more about getting someone over, making them comfortable for a visit, ensuring there's a bathroom and a living room type area on the ground floor. And this can be really powerful when combined with strategies like the cottage housing that we talked about, because these units can be incorporated into a larger site and really encourage a mix of households of all ages and abilities in the same site rather than segregated. Next, please. Okay, this is a fairly minor change. It comes from these reference state statutes, but we just need to make some updates to county definitions around really what's a household and a family, which is sort of the basis of however many people and whatever relationships there are between those people in a household or a family. That's who can live in a single family home or a duplex. And if it's more than that, then you don't qualify as a household. So there need to be some changes to make the definition more neutral and removing potentially discriminatory impacts on households depending on their relationship status. So this is just a housekeeping update. Get it? Household housekeeping. Next, please. This next strategy about reviewing the planned unit development ordinance is, you can see, a medium-term strategy, in part because we really want to focus in the short term on improving and clarifying the by right options by expanding middle housing development, like the plexes, the cottages, the compact subdivision option, And once we have a better sense of what can be permitted outright through those changes in development code, we'll have a better sense about fine-tuning this discretionary planned unit development process to see what additional types of projects and what additional flexibility is needed for projects that maybe can't fit through the new development standards being developed. So next, please. All right, so now we get into some, classic long range planning and also long term strategies. But, while we're working on these shorter term changes to development code, a companion piece for the longer term is to look at upzoning some existing land to bring and or bringing in more higher density zoning for new land as it's brought into the urban growth area. Again, going back to those pie charts about available land, just making sure that there's more high density acreage available for housing as is needed to meet the balance of the county's housing needs. So we'll continue to be monitored and could inform a long-term strategy. Next, please. Likewise, a long-term strategy here is looking at a foundational countywide planning policy that effectively requires all jurisdictions, not just the county and not just for the Vancouver UGA, to look at the current 75-25% split between single family detached housing and alternatives to single family detached housing. And so this policy is part of what drives those pie charts that we looked at, making sure that there can be enough land to meet that 75% while still making sure 25% of units are an alternative to single family detached. But continuing to monitor this in the long term, in the long range, and see if this ratio still matches what the overall housing needs are in the county and specifically within the Vancouver UGA, to see if this is something to be adjusted at the county level or by individual jurisdictions. So next, please. And here we have another medium term strategy. Is considering creation of a new low density zone. The R1 zones are the low density, but this would be the highest density low density zone. If that doesn't, if that doesn't sound too confusing. So right now this would introduce a much smaller scale, zone that would have a 2,500 square foot minimum lot size. And in contrast, currently the smallest R1 zone is the R15 zone that has a 5,000 square foot minimum. So this would really add another opportunity to use that land in low density more efficiently. But we did make this a medium term strategy, given that we've got those short term strategies around things like the compact subdivision, the cluster housing and middle housing, wanting to see what kind of impact those had. That was a higher priority for our PEG members and based coming out of the interviews about how to use the zones we already have before moving in the medium term to reassess whether it makes sense to introduce a new one. Okay, next, please. All right, and then courtyard apartments are smaller scale multifamily projects, 5 to 12 units. Those could potentially fit and be compatible in more medium density zones, high density as well. It is sort of on the higher end of the density range of middle housing. So we felt like this needed additional time to develop some design and development standards to make them truly compatible in within residential neighborhoods. So this is a medium term recommendation, but we do see the potential to move this forward. Next, please. All right, so again, back to the parking topic. Back in strategy HO7, that talks about some short-term changes that we talked about for multifamily parking requirements that are mandated in the short term to meet state requirements. And this strategy here is really a medium-term, longer-range strategy to take a more holistic look and really study what the off-street parking minimums should be for multifamily, if there are ways to match it to the size of unit, the location of unit, the residential population being served, Right now it's a flat 1.5 space for all units regardless. So we're really recommending further study to develop some targeted recommendations here and right size parking for multifamily. So next, please. Okay, and then HO21, this is a bit of a preview in an upcoming strategy around affordable housing. You'll see a recommendation to allow regulated affordable housing projects to be permitted in commercial zones with no commercial component, right? Just a straight up multifamily project. However, in addition to that, in the short term, there was desire within the PEG to look medium term to really explore what flexibility there could be in the commercial and the mixed use zones to better support residential development. Understanding that there's a trade-off, that commercial land is intended to help meet county commercial and economic development goals, and that's why the development standards currently require ground floor residential, limiting residential to up, or I'm sorry, ground floor commercial, limiting residential to upper stories only. But we heard concerns about the development feasibility of that, knowing the demand for multifamily. There was support for continuing to look at how those zones might be more flexible to make it easier to develop residential, possibly including ground floor residential for that goes beyond the regulated affordable housing projects. Okay, next please. Okay, this is another medium term strategy that relates to the Highway 99 plan. This is one where we needed to do further work with our transportation engineers to look at some of the cross circulation requirements. We heard there were some concerns, but we think that this would benefit from further study and review. Next, please. Next is talking about manufactured home parks. And this is a longer term strategy that would involve some monitoring as well as analysis. Manufactured home parks provide currently existing unregulated affordable housing in the sense that it's naturally occurring. They're not necessarily getting subsidies, but they're affordable to households making lower incomes. And in some rapidly developing areas, those manufactured home parks can be subject to pretty intense redevelopment pressures that could lead park owners to sell and redevelop and possibly displacing the residents. And so this strategy is all about getting ahead of that economic redevelopment cycle by studying the existing parks, understanding what the displacement potential could be, and then working to mitigate it and or reduce displacement. All right, next.
So please. This is Zeldin. I have a question on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a huge time sink? Because don't you have to take each existing manufactured home park as a separate entity and look at that? There's no two manufacturing home parks are going to have the same issues. To me, this looks like a huge time sink.
I think that's a really interesting observation. I can't comment on how much is the same and how much is different among the manufactured home parks. I know that some of the strategies that are often discussed around, as is mentioned here, enhanced notification, offering relocation assistance if parks are closed. Those types of strategies would really be less dependent on the specifics of the park. I would certainly say, there's a range of what the county would do versus efforts by other advocates and partners. For example, converting to tenant ownership, right? Giving tenants an opportunity to purchase the park and create it as either a condo or a co-op, or I might not be getting the legal structure right, but giving them an opportunity to own the ground in addition to their manufactured homes. That is a tremendous, on the ground, park by park effort, but that's often not taken on by a government agency. That's often taken on by a nonprofit. And so that's something where perhaps there is, a county policy that could help support it, but it wouldn't be the county's responsibility or really capacity or ability to go and advocate for, particular economic structures.
All right. I just didn't understand how this had much impact on affordable housing at all. So,
yeah, I think, right. And that really points to both like the potential and the downside of existing manufactured home parks is they can be easy to overlook. And however, they can provide really powerful and unexpectedly large sources of affordable housing that are not dependent on government subsidy, such as, you know, your more traditional multifamily projects. And so part of this study would really be trying to understand how many of these parks exist in the Vancouver UGA, how they're helping the county meet affordable housing needs. And based on that, understanding, you know, how to either support or, you know, mitigate impacts related to any changes to those parks.
Okay,
I think we are ready. Thank you. Okay, so we are back to, this is a related strategy looking at RVs and tiny homes. So in addition to expanding where RV parks can be permitted, as we talked about, this is about, you know, setting RVs free from the RV parks and looking at whether they could be accommodated in some residential zones, either on individual lots, more like an ADU, and or, you know, potentially very small scale RV parks in high density residential zones. So this is a medium term strategy, again, would follow upon that initial strategy about expanding RV parks. Next, please. All right, you're in, I believe this is our last code related or housing options. This is a long-term strategy because this is also a significant effort of analysis, but to do a comprehensive review of impact fees that reflect this greater variety of dwelling types being provided and permitted under the proposed code amendments, to better understand the impacts relative to smaller footprints and household sizes, while ensuring overall that there is adequate funding for necessary infrastructure development that meets the needs for the county, you know, on a system-wide basis. So that's a longer-term effort to make sure that all those infrastructure plans can be met. So next, please. All right, so that wraps.
Yeah, sorry, you got it.
Yep, that wraps up the code related strategies and the other sort of long range strategies. But I do have two in this affordable housing category to talk to you since they have a code focus as well. So next, please.
Elizabeth, maybe we should just pause here to see if there's any general questions. We're halfway through. Congratulations, everybody. And just to see if there's any comments on those housing option strategies that you presented before we move to the next category.
Well, this is Eldon on that last one, AO25. Is the thought there that the impact fees would be reduced?
The thought is that they would be scaled so that the, generally speaking, smaller housing units that have less of an impact, you know, less toilet flushing, less trips generated, would pay less impact fee than a larger housing unit that is creating more impacts.
Any other questions or comments at this time?
This is Aldo. Just I'm trying to form my question here. I think about the group that's been so instrumental in pulling all this information together, many voices, many perspectives from all the various tracks and diversities of life. And are they a one voice in offering these strategies, or do you find that some are leaning more in favor of some strategies over another? I'm trying to get a sense, and actually, Eldon, you asked us earlier about how you would regroup these and distill it down even more to get as close to a tactical plan as possible. These still seem very high level. You're not yet in the implementation space. And I was curious to see if certain groups were weighing in heavily on some of these over others as a way to weed them out even more. This is a long list of things to consider.
I agree with you, Aldo. It's a long, long list. And there's, to me, it seems like it can get reduced and make it more manageable.
So, and to go along with that, I have a comment that I want to share with you now that's really about the summary of all this, because and then we'll look at this when you get at the end of the deck. There is a proposed action section, right? And there's a statement about starting with the short-term strategies, which makes sense, but you don't list and summarize in a table the short-term strategies. I had to go back through the deck and look at all of the bulleted items and figure out which ones are the short-term strategies. So I think for the readers, the audience, and the consumability, to bring this to a really clear focus, to have a summary that goes along with the statement. Our first things first will be to work on the short-term strategies, which, as you identify, will be a year or less. Oh, and as a recap, here is a summary table of those short-term strategies, which probably will be a cross-section of picked from your groupings, just to help people to get their arms around the content. Just offering that up. But awesome effort in getting this kind of information down and chunkable. That's what I call it. Thank you.
So I'll start, then I'm going to hand it over to Jackie and Oliver. I heard three questions. One concern. Well, the first question was about, did the people we worked with advocate for any one strategy over others, or where were they leaning? I think my answer to that is that, we brought a lot of different perspectives to the table, and some people have more concern about providing affordable housing to those, very low and extremely low income households. And then some folks who are a person who's a housing developer of middle housing might be more focused on some of the measures that Elizabeth just presented. So we really moved forward with the strategies that had pretty much consensus support from the project advisory group. That's the list that you're seeing before you today. So that's my answer to that. Thank you for the note about the short-term strategies, having to go back through the document. I think there's probably various ways that we can address that concern, whether it's moving them up into the executive summary or summarizing them after the table. I appreciate that and apologize that that was a difficult task to have to go back through that list and pick those out. And then in terms of, I think the last question is, or statement is just that it's a large list and, can it be narrowed down further? And I think that's, I'll just say one challenge to doing that is in terms of how much work we want to do. It would be maybe not the most responsible use of resources to provide, to flesh out the details of every one of these strategies, only to have them, not move forward through this. Commission and council review. So we wanted to give a presentation to you at this point in time where we're still, like you said, a little bit at that higher level strategy, and people and we can get some guidance as to here's the ones that, we want you to do more work on, and maybe we don't want you to do work on these other ones, rather than us doing work on all 50 and then finding out that the county's not interested in moving forward with some of them. So that's one perspective on that, but I'd like for Jackie and or Oliver to respond to that question as well.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, I can jump in, and Oliver might want to as well. But I think It is a long list, and the advisory group went through the same kind of, you know, discussion and had a hard time, you know, thinking about taking things off because we had such a wide variety of perspectives, and we wanted to provide the opportunity for people to learn more about them and get some direction from county leadership on what, you know, what they are interested in pursuing. It's a plan, so it's got a lot in there, and some of the short-term strategies are kind of there are a lot of code changes that are packaged together, right? You'll come before it in a packet of code changes. So we're used to doing that and can do that. And our goal is, and as we'll talk about a little bit at the end, is this monitoring and, you know, coming before the council on an annual basis during community planning's work program discussion to give an update. Okay, this is what we've done with the housing option study and action plan so far upon your direction. What do you want to look forward to for the following year for planning to work on? So we're chunking it out, and it depends on what the interest of the council, you know, wants to take on at that point, and what's of interest to them to work on implementing. And like a lot of them, everything, you know, that's legislative will, you know, come through another decision process to accomplish. Right.
So will they be recommending order and sequencing and priority out of all these strategies? They are going to provide guidance to bring it to an initial focus area first. Correct.
Right. What we foresee are the goal is to, you know, encourage the momentum and get going on the short term ones that they choose to move forward for implementation work. And then, and anything else, I mean, it's up to that. They're like throw a long term or a medium term in there. You know, we'll have that discussion with council. Right. But the goal is then to continuously check in and be like, okay, we've done this. Here's what we can propose, what we think could come next, but have that conversation with council annually to gauge that.
Okay, so you provide them with this continuous feedback of data that shows them what's working, what's not working, and how long things are taking.
Yes, and the ones that we haven't picked up yet, you know, see which ones they want to kickstart for the following year.
Okay, it's so important with this that when all is said and done, that it doesn't look like the optics don't look like you're boiling the ocean, because right now it does. And so again, that just, I think that summary slide for their short-term items really begin to bring it to a laser focus. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate that feedback. That's very helpful.
That answer everyone's questions for now? Okay.
Yes, Steve, I don't have anything to add. I think you and Jackie covered it very well. I agree with Steve that the PAC Project Advisory Group did mull over some of these strategies, some focus on how could we address homelessness, if you will, and some focus on what could be done in the short term. But overall, they all came to consensus that these strategies are ones that we should be recommending to the council moving forward. Thank you for the suggestion about perhaps in the executive summary identifying those short-term strategies and list and identify them in the executive summary. Similarly, with strategies, there are some, I'm glad that the group also and with staff identify those that could be done in 2 to 3 years, 3 years and above. So regularly we'll be checking in with council because they approve our work program. As we said earlier, this is not something we will put up on the shelf. We will be dialoguing with the community and the council to see which of these strategies should we be working on an annual basis? After that, we'll move to the next one. And the same is true in terms of monitoring, so that we could also be reporting to the community, this is how well we are doing. I'll give you an example. And someone asked a question about impact fees, and Elizabeth answered it very well. As we do a study to see the impact of impact fees, for example, as it relates to housing affordability, that could also be scaled down. If you are approving ADU, accessory dwelling unit, should I pay the same as a single family, for example? And that is somewhere that you can scale back the assessment of impact fees, for example. And you can also assess or monitor how many of these cottage housing or ADUs are being approved on a yearly basis, so we can see that the changes we made the code is really having an impact. If you make these changes and no one is building cottage housing, you haven't really done much. So there will be monitoring, there will be adjustment as we go forward, so that this plan is being implemented. It's not going to be implemented just like that. It's going to be gradual. And like I said earlier, we're going to be monitoring, you know, state role in all of this. They're coming up with some funding, they're coming up with other regulations. We will see how that will impact this study.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Elizabeth. I think you might be on mute.
You are correct. Thank you. Just two more to hear from me about, and I think all these questions are really thoughtful to keep in your mind as you're evaluating these 50 strategies of, you know, how do they relate? How are they impactful? How to, you know, how do we sort through them, and are they in the right buckets in terms of short term and scaling up or scaling down or moving forward or, you know, moving something else forward instead? So glad to be at this work session to discuss all those pieces and get feedback to keep this moving forward and keep it getting refined. Our first strategy that is identified to specifically assist with providing affordable housing, and those again are those regulated projects that are specifically targeting households, you know, it depends on the exact project, but, you know, below 80% or below 60% of the area median income, where the market is really not going to provide any options affordable at those prices. So looking, one particular strategy that came up here that we can work on in a short term is explicitly making affordable housing projects that are generally multifamily, making those a permitted use in all commercial zones and eliminating that ground floor commercial requirement for affordable housing projects. And that expands the amount of land that could be eligible to do these affordable housing projects when a community partner is able to secure those tax credits. And so we heard loud and clear from those advocates within the PAG process that this was really key. City of Vancouver has been doing something similar and has been seeing some good results. So we wanted to get that onto the short-term list. And next, AH2. There is also an emerging model, it's really come during the pandemic, of converting existing motels and hotels into affordable housing options, either that are a more temporary use, more similar to motels and hotels in terms of temporary lodging, or even into permanent affordable housing, you know, more apartment type units. And so this strategy is just in the short term, taking a look at the county's code to make sure that there's more clarity around how those standards apply, and if there's any further code updates that need to be done to clarify how those projects can move forward and happen under the code. All right, and with that, I'm turning it over to Steve to talk about the second.
Thanks, Elizabeth, and I'll walk us through the rest of the strategies. AH3 is listed as medium term, but there is a short-term component to it. And that is to implement bonus density for affordable housing on religious organizations' land. That is a state mandated piece of this strategy. So that would be more of a short-term piece of this. But in the medium term, the project advisory group recommended that that the county consider extending that bonus for affordable housing affordable housing to non-religious organizations that meet the affordability, the same affordability and time duration requirements. So the short-term piece is on religious organizations land. The PAG would like the county to consider extending that bonus to non-religious organizations as long as they meet those requirements. Next slide, please. AH4 is a longer-term strategy and related to one we heard about earlier, taking that comprehensive review of impact fees. And this takes it a step further, which is considering implementing up to an 80% impact fee reduction for regulated affordable housing. So a little different than earlier where Elizabeth was talking about the scaling piece of impact fees. This would be looking at reducing fees for impact fees further for regulated affordable housing, which is authorized by state legislation. Also, again, the reason we want to take time with this is that it's important that the county continue to maintain current revenue levels.
Steve, I have a question on that one. This is Aldo.
Yeah.
On this one, we're talking about reducing impact fees up to 80%. Is there an impact for reducing impact fees that much? Because the statement says while maintaining revenue levels. So if you just look at a simple checkbook, you've got a minus sign and a minus column and a plus column, right? You reduce in one area, and if you're going to commit to maintaining the revenue levels, you have to increase someplace else to make up the difference.
Exactly.
So I like the idea, but from a financial feasibility, I don't know if it's doable or not.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly right. That, you know, that's why you can't just look at affordable housing in isolation. You need to look at the entire impact fee system. And if it's a priority for the county to provide regulated affordable housing, then something they can consider is lowering the impact fees for those for that type of housing and potentially making up that lost revenue by increasing fees for other types. I think you hit the nail right on the head.
Yep. That the watchword there is maintaining current revenue levels.
Yep, that's why that's in there. But thanks for calling.
So Steve, this,
thank you.
So Steve, this is Eldon. Where did the 80% come from? How did you come up with 80?
So I should have started with the fact that I am not the expert in my strategies that Elizabeth is in hers, but I'm pretty certain that number comes from the legislation that's cited there. Jackie, do you know any more about that specific number?
To be honest, no. I'd want to go look it up and kind of take a look at it, and we can send that to the Planning Commission. We can send the RCW so that everyone can take a look.
Right. I'm pretty sure though that number, you know, is the number that is included, and that's why in that legislation, and that's why we included that there. Okay. Next. This one came from one of our other partners, Echo Northwest, and their study of housing and demographics in the county. And one tool they recommended is exploring the potential of a county tax increment financing tool to support affordable housing goals. And then, you know, including in that study, which geographies, what parts of our study area would be best suited for a tax increment financing tool district.
This is Eldon. I don't understand that.
Okay.
County tax increment financing, is there information that could be sent to us on that? I don't know what that entails.
And I could describe it briefly. Hopefully I won't get us into more trouble than it's worth, but essentially a tax increment financing district holds tax levels. I've got to get this right. Holds tax levels steady and uses any improvements and increases in, well, you know what? I lost my train of thought. Elizabeth or Jackie, are you able to better define tax increment financing? I think it's similar to an urban renewal district.
Yeah, I can offer a little bit that I understand from ECO, although this isn't my expertise either. Tax increment essentially says it takes the base, right, and says this is how much tax you're getting right now, and the increment is the additional tax that's generated for a set period of time within a set district, presumably as a result of some of the development and investments, for example, like infrastructure investment, and that increment of tax that's over and above the base for that defined time or area, then can be directed into a fund that can support affordable housing goals, either by, you know, purchasing land or perhaps reducing impact fees or other sort of financial investments in affordable housing projects. So it's a revenue generating tool.
Oh, so like the state of Oregon, they have ticker checks where they send back to the taxpayers when the state gets more money. Is that similar to this? Like they get more revenue than they expected, so they're going to use that extra revenue to support affordable housing?
I think it's a little different. I think essentially it holds. So whatever the current, so for this defined area, whatever the current tax base is, holds steady for a certain period of time, 10 years or 20 years. And during that 10 or 20 years, increases in tax revenue are then available to be put into a fund that can be used, as Elizabeth said, to support affordable housing goals.
That sounds like a tax levy.
No, it sounds like a tax levy. Yeah, exactly.
There's no increase in taxes for people in the district.
But if extra revenue is coming in, then right. That's coming from the taxpayers.
Sure. The idea, though, is that the overall tax base in this area is increasing in the time period. And so if there's, I'll just make up numbers, $100 million in taxable property at the beginning of the TIF district, that as the development continues, maybe it gets up to $120 million of taxable property. And so it's not that all of those property owners are paying a higher rate, it's that there is more taxable property. And so those additional revenues, instead of just going into the county general fund, are directed specifically into this tax increment. So it's just a way of divvying up the taxes that would otherwise be collected.
I would need to see a lot more detail on that.
So. Okay, indeed, a long range strategy. There's a lot of details here.
And in the meantime, I can reach out to Echo Northwest and see if they have a primer that we can share with the Planning Commission.
All right.
Okay, next. AH6 is exploring development standards bonuses for affordable housing to meet the needs of the study area in consultation with affordable housing providers to try to impact changes. So these are things like, again, we mentioned parking reductions, density bonuses, things like that for affordable housing projects that meet certain criteria. So you heard about some of these things before relative to desired housing types, but we weren't talking about affordable housing. Here we're talking about, do we want to apply some of these bonuses to affordable housing projects?
So Steve, I wanted to ask you, this is Aldo, how are the bonuses funded?
Things like parking reductions or density bonuses, I don't think those require funding. Right? It's similar to some of the incentives that Elizabeth presented earlier, not incentives, but code changes for middle housing or multifamily housing. But in this case, we're kind of focused more on affordable housing projects.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. And I would say that we use the word bonuses here, but in air quotes, because we mean that, you know, these are really incentives that can be given in the form of differentiated code standards that can translate into a cost savings for affordable housing developers, but may not cost the county anything to provide.
Okay, it would be probably good to just define that term a little bit to help folks be clear about what you mean there.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good recommendation.
Sure.
Thank you. Now let's go to the next one. AH7, this is reviewing the land use and the non-life safety engineering standards that are used to review projects and see if there are opportunities to reduce barrier for these low-income housing projects while still producing high-quality development. And a few examples of those you can see at the bottom of the strategy are things like landscaping, turnaround, or sidewalk standards. So those standards that are not in the life, non-life safety category. Next slide. And with that, those were our affordable housing strategies. And now we're going to move to the programs and partnerships. Next slide. Many of these are administrative, so you should see that as we go along, the programmatic ones. This is reducing development review timelines for select projects by finding ways to combine and streamline engineering and or building permit reviews. We heard from some stakeholders that reviews are often done, different reviews, land use, engineering, are done in succession that possibly could be done concurrently. So this is something, a longer term strategy that the county could look at to try to reduce those timelines for permit review.
Is there a goal there? Like, do we know, does it like take 9 months typically now or what?
I would defer to Jackie on that.
Yeah, and I would get Susan because she's the most familiar with the review timelines. And Sonia, it looks like she fell into the attendee box. Could you move her back into the panel so she could?
Yes. She's a panelist.
Okay.
Susan? Susan, are you there?
There she is. I think you're muted. Susan, are you muted? Uh-oh.
I can't hear you, Susan.
Well, getting back to that slide, if Susan's not available, if they could provide clarity on here saying, okay, currently projects are currently lasting, blah, blah, blah. We would like to see if we can reduce it to something less and have it a specific amount.
Great. Thanks for that suggestion. And Susan, if you if we're able to hear you at some point, feel free to interrupt me and we can go back to this one.
All right.
Let's go to the next slide. So we heard from a lot of stakeholders, especially in the development community, that having a point of contact at the county to provide education and help developers understand and use various affordable housing incentives would be a beneficial strategy. Next slide. So PP3. This is a medium-term strategy, is really, you know, again, these medium and long-term strategies also often are studies. And again, in this one, it's trying to figure out ways how to best encourage and support neighborhood retail uses within neighborhoods. You know, the examples that were provided were holding workshops with residents and property owners, doing an analysis of the neighborhood commercial zone. This gets to that fifth objective that we had of trying to locate housing closer to these types of amenities or locate these types of amenities closer to where housing is being built. Next. PP4, you'll see that some of these strategies relate to having good information to inform future decision-making. This is one of those. Study ongoing housing production trends and a prevalence of certain housing types in limited, medium, and high density zoned land. So for example, if single family is predominating in medium density zones, we might want to create greater opportunity for middle housing types in those zones. So really kind of tracking what type of housing is getting built in different zones so we can make future recommendations accordingly. Next is exploring options to increase access to neighborhood scale retail and service uses such as coffee shops within existing neighborhoods. Again, looking at what might make make these types of uses more viable in existing residential neighborhoods.
How does this help affordable housing?
This is not an affordable housing strategy. This is, again, in line with the fifth objective that the project advisory group came up with, which is focused on making sure that housing is getting built next to amenities such as commercial retail, such as parks, such as other sorts of services that help people meet their daily needs. Trying to find ways to encourage housing to be built with access to those types of services, and likewise for those types of services to be provided in areas that are predominantly housing.
Thank you.
And Steve, I'll also mention just transportation costs are a big part of household incomes.
Yeah.
And especially for those on lower income scales that may not have cars or don't typically drive, being able to get around without an automobile can help their bottom line as well.
Thanks, Jackie. So PP6, this is reviewing the county's master permit program to determine if any adjustments can be made to improve the program or if a different approach to master permitting is preferred. This is one that Susan could, another one that Susan could probably speak to. Were we able to get Susan? No. Okay, we'll keep moving forward.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
All right, let's start with PP6. Do you want to say anything about the master permit program, Susan?
Just some of you might have known this program as the same as program previously. It's a building permit program basically that allows a unit to be reviewed, and it can possibly allow some modifications to that unit, but the building review is already done, and so future reviews of that same unit can be much less review or essentially almost no review if there are no changes to it. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Susan. That's helpful to explain that one. And then let's hop back to PP1 because there was a question about essentially, what do review times look like now for permits, and what would be the goal, a realistic goal in streamlining or improving those timelines?
So concurrent review here is talking about mostly the final engineering and land use process, and the possibility of combining the two of those and having those processes happen at the same time. So normally the process is to do land use review basically, that's followed by the final engineering process, and you can't start the final engineering process until land use is complete. And we would look at the possibility of combining either those parts of the review, or you can also, look at combining the building permit portion of the review, which normally comes after final engineering, with the final engineering review. So there's different types of combinations that can make the process go faster.
Is it safe to say that you could get like a 20 or 30% reduction in timeline review timelines?
I'm hesitant to quantify it. We could maybe work on something like that, but I guess I'm a little hesitant to quantify it because we have some different options we could look at. And so until we have that kind of an op, have something worked out. I would have trouble quantifying it.
This is, although I just wanted to comment also on this, Susan. This is a very powerful thing to say. When it's time to quantify it, some examples would help convince the public that the planning and development department is very serious about this, because it sounds like the intention behind this is to fast track some of these projects that maybe are a bit more urgent around affordable housing than others. I also notice on the little indicators across the bottom that this is a long-term item. This is not something that's a quick turnaround. Yet, having been through this process several times myself with various projects, everyone wants to go faster, right? And it would be difficult to meet such an urgency around affordable housing if the process takes too long.
Amen.
Okay, so it will be great to really give this some teeth when you take the strategy and take it to a tactical implementation level, what the opportunities are for savings. I noticed the words at the beginning of the presentation, the word that repeats most often is encourage, encourage, encourage. And if even going through the process of taking these kinds of housing projects through development, we want to remove barriers and encourage people as many ways as we can. So seeing time reductions would further motivate and encourage people to take this on. It's a feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry. I've had connection problems all night and I was scrambling to get back on and get back to this so I could talk to you about this. But anyways, I did misspeak just a little bit in that at first I talked about, when we talk about concurrent review in land use, we're frequently talking about the land use and the development final engineering process. And this one is geared at for the triplex and quadplex projects. It is geared towards that, so they could go to building permit with after one review, a single review with land.
Yes, you rolled that out. Yes, I remember. Yeah, that was something new you did recently from all the feedback from the public and whatnot and studies. Yep.
Yeah. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, thanks. It is a step in the right direction, but putting some numbers around it will really show some teeth.
Okay.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, commissioners, for the comments. Thank you, Susan. Don't go anywhere. Okay. Now we're on PP7, I believe. And this is supporting what I believe is a already ongoing initiative to move to electronic plan review. I think that's many jurisdictions have moved in that direction for ease of submitting plans and speeding up and facilitating the review process. PP8, developing a marketing and communication plan for any changes to code or other strategies regarding housing options. So really publicizing the key strategies that move forward out of this process. You could look at this along with similar to the single point of contact to help with affordable housing strategies, just really helping people understand what the different strategies and incentives are. Next, PP9, another data tracking one. Monitor housing development, especially multifamily, over time. And this was really important to the PAG member who brought this up, that we should really be noting the number and type of units produced, sizes of units, density, parking provided, sale or rent levels, and use of any fee or tax incentives. So really tracking all that data, again, in hopes of better informing future recommendations and decision making. PP10.
I'm sorry, yep. This is Eldon. On that last one, aren't we already monitoring building activity on what's being built?
Susan or Jackie, do you want to field that one?
Go ahead, Oliver.
This is Oliver. Yes, we are monitoring the number of units built. If it's relating to affordable units, we are not doing that yet. So as we move forward and there are what we may consider affordable housing or affordable units, that's where this monitoring will also be expanded to identify those affordable units or different type of additional housing units that are being provided. Right now, we are just showing number of multi-family unit built or number of single family built in any given year. So that's the type of information that we are currently collecting. We can reach out to, real estate companies that are monitoring sales and rent level and collect that type of data. Now, use of fees or taxing incentives, we don't have any of that we could be monitoring. But as we move forward, any of these strategies that we begin to implement and seeing some result, that's how this is going to be monitored and report out. But currently, all we do is collect number of single family and multi-family built.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
PP10, this relates to some of our earlier discussion about manufactured homes. We heard from a lot of members of the broader public at our meetings during the public comment period about the need for more information and ways to preserve mobile and manufactured home parks. And one of the strategies they recommended was just providing more information on the county webpage for people who live in these housing types, so they have more information. Because as Elizabeth mentioned, these parks can be the recipients of a lot of development pressure, and it's helpful for owners of those homes to understand what resources are out there for them. PP11, monitor and support state and partner efforts to monitor regulated affordable housing properties that are nearing their affordability expiration dates. So I believe this is something that other agencies currently do to help notify people who live in these types of developments when any affordability provisions are expiring. And this is just a strategy to help coordinate and support those efforts. PP12, adopt a notice of intent to sell ordinance that would require owners of multifamily buildings to provide official notification to tenants and local housing officials if that building or development, those homes are going to be sold. PP13, PAG members really valued the partnership the county has with the Vancouver Housing Authority, and they thought it would be worthwhile for the county and the housing authority to develop strategies and just identify ways in which the county can support the housing authority in achieving its mission. PP14, again, more data tracking, inventorying the available public lands annually, and then that would allow the county to determine if it wants to donate or lease public lands to, for instance, affordable housing developers to reduce the cost of development and make those projects more feasible. PP15, research the impacts of short-term rentals in Clark County, and if needed, develop a county policy around those short-term rentals. We know that short-term rentals have an impact on available housing in other communities, but we don't know if that's the case in our study area. So the recommendation was to study that, and if there is an impact on available affordable housing or available housing, then to consider what type of strategies, if any, should be moved forward.
Steve, just a quick question, clarification. Short-term rental, are you talking Airbnb or not Airbnb?
Yeah, that would be a type of short-term rental, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Steve, if I may add, there are some other companies or investors who also are acquiring properties and at a much, much higher price range and just sitting on it or renting it out. So in addition to Airbnb, there are other phenomena that we're also seeing. So that will fall into this category. Thank you.
Thank you. And the final strategy in this category, we're getting close to the end here. This is PP16. We haven't talked a lot about our aging and people with disabilities, those communities. And this is working with advocates for those populations to help develop a universal design program that it would encourage more housing options for those in the community that are disabled or mobility challenged. All right, we'll pause again and ask if there are any questions about those programs and partnerships strategies that we haven't heard yet. And if not, we have just two more strategies to describe here in the advocacy category. The first is that to continue what I understand is ongoing council advocacy efforts to expand the multifamily tax exemption to counties that is currently available to cities, but not to counties. And the PAG took that a step further and said that if it does become a tool that's available to counties, that they recommend it be implemented with an income target range in the 50% to 80% AMI. So if that tool is approved or is made a viable tool for the county, the PAG would like to see an income target of 50% to 80% AMI.
What is AMI?
Area median income.
Okay, thank you.
And then finally, our last strategy is A2, supporting legislative changes that would fix issues with the state's condominium defect liability law. And I understand that this bill, Senate Bill 5024, was passed, but at this time we're unsure what the impact might be and if additional legislative change might be needed. So that's one that we'll continue to monitor. All right. So thank you for your questions and comments as we went through those items. Just a few notes here on implementation and monitoring. Next slide. So if the council approves the plan and strategies, as we mentioned, county staff will begin the work to implement the short-term strategies. After the initial batch of strategies is implemented, council, as Jackie explained earlier, may identify additional strategies to implement. And then the proposed monitoring program will provide a system for measuring the effectiveness of those strategies in achieving the five objectives we presented earlier. It will also include an annual update to council on the progress of implementing those strategies. And then finally, staff recommends the Planning Commission forward a recommendation of approval of the Housing Options Study and Action Plan, including directing staff to immediately begin implementation work of those short-term strategies. And with that, we'll pause again and see if there are any questions or discussion.
Sure, Brian Halbert here. And just on the monitoring, Is that going to be additional county staff that will be put on, and are they funded to do the monitoring of this program?
So what we're envisioning is that as we develop the strategy, so if it's a code change, that part of the implementation process will be developing whatever, how we're going to monitor it. So that would be county staff that we already have, that we foresee utilizing our resources that we have to track those and be able to share that publicly is kind of what the goal would be. So, and then of course, just the annual check-in community planning, working with council on how to continue implementation of the strategies in the plan.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
This is Eldon. I think I heard Oliver say at the beginning of the meeting that possibly the Planning Commission could also be getting updates from the monitoring. Isn't that right, Oliver?
Yes. If it's a report, which I think it will be, we will be sharing that with the Planning Commission and the community at large.
Okay. And then another comment, implement all the short-term strategies. Not all the short-term strategies are going to have an impact on the affordable housing goals. So it may not make sense to try to implement all of them. Some of them may have very little impact. I think that there should be more work done on which ones are going to have more impact and work on those short-term strategies.
Okay.
Steve. This is Matt Swindell. Hey, I kind of take a different approach on that, Eldon. I really like the idea that you've got all of these things that you guys are thinking about. Now, you're not going to implement everything all at once. You're going to look at what can be done quickly. You're looking at what's long-term, medium-term, short-term. I really, really like this huge shotgun effect of let's look at everything and see how we can bring it in over the next couple of years, because as a previous developer builder, there's so many times that you're just caught in this paradigm of, well, this is the way we do it. This is the way we do it. But there's so many different ways of doing it. And maybe some of them aren't as good, but that's this process. You're going to go through the process. You're going to figure out, is it working better? Is it not working better? Monitoring it, bringing it back. I really like this. There's like, out of all of those, I've got three written down that I kind of go, I don't know if I really like those. But as a holistic thing, I mean, you kind of have to take it as it is and say, okay, I really like this plan. I like how you guys are really looking at all the various things that we can do. And in fact, I mean, you probably had 100-150 at least ideas. I got a lot of ideas. That doesn't mean they're all good. But what you've done is narrowed it down to 50 potentially good ideas. And then you're going to bring it in even more focused over the next 6 months, a year, right? That's kind of the plan here. I really like it. I think you guys have done a wonderful job. That's all I want to say.
Well, I agree with you, Matt. I think it's a great overall. I still think the 80-20 rule applies, that 20% of the strategies are going to get you 80% of the bang.
And they'll figure that out as they go through this process. I think that's the we're just at the beginning. I know we're in the middle of it or at the end of a certain point of this process, but really we're at the end of a new beginning, or the beginning of an end, I guess you'd say, because they're starting a whole nother process now. And I think they're going in the right direction. I think they're going to go.
This is Aldo. I actually, I agree with Matt. We all like to have choices. Even in, the projects that I manage, my philosophy is find the good ones that work fast. So really what I'm saying is fail fast, fail early, and get focused on the ones that produce the results you want. Right, Matt, huh?
I like that. Fail fast and fail early.
Yeah. That's my philosophy.
I like it. Steve, do you have any questions or comments you want to make?
We just have this last slide, just reminding you we're at the beginning of this last phase, or maybe the beginning of a new phase, as you said earlier, depending on how you look at it. But we're here at the beginning of April. We're going to see you in another few weeks, and then we will do the same with County Council, and that will take us into June. And then we'll have clear guidance on what's going to move forward and what isn't. Jackie, anything else to add today? Or Oliver?
I don't think so. I just want to make sure we don't have any other questions. We have two Steves on here, so I didn't want to make sure that making sure any and if any other planning commissioners have any more comments.
I'm sorry, Steve. I was asking Steve Moresh if he had any questions. He hasn't really said too much tonight.
No, I'm just I've just been listening this a lot of material. I'll want to go afterwards and read through it again. Okay. I do better reading sometimes than listening. So at this point, no, I don't have any questions or comments. But thank you for the presentation. Okay. Sorry, I tried to start my video while I was talking, but got a new phone here that I'm working with. So. Learning how to reinstall WebEx and making sure it works. But anyway, yeah, good presentation.
Bryant, do you have any questions or comments?
Well, some of it I lost connectivity, but I think I'm a little bit in Elvin's court. I think it's a little broad in terms of moving forward. But there's a lot of, I think, substantive information that council and staff can use as they move forward. So I'll read a little bit more of this and be prepared at the next meeting. Thank you.
Okay. Any commissioners, anything else? Aldo, Eldon, anything? Brian?
Yeah. I have maybe a question as we look at these 50 strategies and what is expected from us next in 2 weeks. Are we going to be looking at these strategies and recommending what we think should be a priority strategy, or is that going to be up to the Clark County, the council to prioritize these strategies? Are you looking for us to make more comments on the strategies, update them?
That's a good question, and I'll have Oliver jump in too as well. There's a lot of strategies, right? Yes. And it's taken the project advisory group a year to go through them, and there's still some of them are more detailed than others, and some will all of them will need more work, and they may not all hash out as we want them to, right? So I think the goal is for you all to our recommendation is for the Planning Commission to approve the plan, right, as it was scoped to be developed, right? We were tasked to come up with an action plan. So the advisory group completed their work, and here is the plan, right? It's not adopting anything or making any changes. It's purely, yes, this was the work was done. Good job. Yay. And then, the way to move it forward, get started on something immediately, if we can keep that momentum, and we know that we still have consultant time to get some of those short-term strategy work done, so utilizing that momentum to also kickstart that.
So, and I'd like to echo a little bit of what Matt said. It's an amazing plan. There's a lot of pieces there. I like that there's a lot of pieces, and I don't think they need to be pared down. I think, like Matt said, they're going to play themselves out over the next year. Some of the pieces will be the right things to move forward, and others will fall off. So I do like having the way that you've laid it out. It's an amazing study and a great plan and a roadmap for moving forward. I don't like every one of the pieces, like Matt was saying, but in general, it's a really good piece to continue to discuss and move forward. So
And I would say, you know, definitely weigh in during your deliberation if there's, you know, something you want to share about what you feel about, you know, about. So, I mean, I think the council would appreciate, you know, feedback that you provide to them as we move forward.
Okay.
Well, that's a good suggestion, Jackie, but we would have to keep track of and maybe take a first cut list and see if we could all agree that, okay, these X number ones as a commission thinks these should be de-emphasized or left behind. That would require some work with 50 elements and no real dialogue between us as a group until we come back together. So
I think you're just looking for individual opinions on the different strategies at that point.
Yes.
To go through some kind of sorting, ranking, or voting process, what we agree as a mind share to keep in and what we don't really align with.
I don't think that we're voting to remove or add anything to it. We're commenting on the report.
Yeah, this is Oliver. And one of your suggestions was to look at the executive section of the report and see if we staff can narrow down the short-term list so that is helpful to you. As Elizabeth indicated, there are some of these strategies that are interrelated. So over time, we are going to be looking at them and seeing those that are interrelated and maybe combining them. Some of those work is something that we staff will be doing if and when the council direct us to implement the strategy. So I thank you for your questions. We'll do our best to see if we can narrow down the short-term list and see if you agree with our assessment of those. What you have, as Jackie indicated, is the recommendation of the task force that worked on this. And you are more than free to let us know what you think about them and then make your recommendation to the council. If there's some of this that you feel shouldn't be considered at this time, we will welcome that observation. And I believe that as you look at the report, you will find out that there's some of this that are very well related, and separating them may not be helpful if we were to combine them as we implement the strategies. I think that would be very helpful. So take your time, read them, let us know what you think as we go to a hearing. And in the interim, if you have questions, feel free to reach out to me or Jackie or Susan or Jenna. We will be able to I think I took note on some areas that you would like some further clarification. That may also be helpful as you begin your deliberations. So thank you for your time, and we look forward to seeing you at your hearings.
Okay. If everybody's got all their comments done and questions, then I think we can call that an adjournment.
Yes. Vice Chair, let me quickly say that your next meeting will be hybrid, and the council is moving into a hybrid in person. So you're welcome to return back to the dais, and we will do our best. We can also, some staff has the opportunity to be virtual or be in person. So you're now welcome to see each other. There is no requirement to wear mask or social distance. We cannot enforce that as there are no mandate on that. So you're welcome to come back to the sixth floor beginning at your next hearing.
Well, then I will see you there.
That's great. And do you anticipate a lot of public comment on this at the hearing? I've noticed that there isn't a lot of public comments in the file just yet.
Yeah, not yet. Oh, sorry, Oliver, go ahead.
Not yet. The legal for your hearing will soon go out. And also the link to the actual report will also be provided, so as the public have opportunity to read the report, hopefully they will have questions or comment coming in. Throughout the project, we have been receiving comments, and throughout the project, the public was welcome to participate, and our consultant and staff provided opportunity during each of the meeting for the public to weigh in and participate. I'm anticipating that there will be comments as the CEPA goes out and the link is provided so that people can read and know exactly what is it that they're going to be commenting on.
Could be a long night.
Yes.
A lot of strategies to deliberate.
We may need some coffee or something to keep us awake.
We will do our best to, it's a lot. We'll do our best to, if we can. I can tell Elizabeth and Steve on how to give the presentation, but this is reporting back on the work that they've done and the project advisory group. One of the things that I like about this is that at least they came to a consensus on what is it that they're recommending. There is no dissenters, so I appreciate that in their work.
Well, both Steve and Elizabeth did a terrific job of staying on task. It was really good. There's just a lot to cover.
Yep.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So with that, I guess we'll adjourn.
All right, everyone. Thank you.
Good job, Matt.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
There we go.
Thanks. Good night.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.